Welcome to the Scandal of Reading podcast. In this season, we are discussing the fruits of the Spirit. In this episode in particular, I discuss love. By discussing Revelations of Divine Love by Julian of Norwich, and I discuss the book with the medievalist Grace Hammond, the author of Jesus Through Medieval Eyes. Grace and I relish this opportunity to get to dive deeply into Julian's work, but trying to keep the conversation in only 30 minutes means that we did not go as deep as we would have wanted to. I encourage all of you to pick up a copy of Julian Norwich's Revelations of Divine Love. For years, I have used Elizabeth Spearing's translation published by Penguin, and recently have discovered Father John Julian's translation with Paraclete Press, which I highly recommend.
Hey friends, welcome back to The Scandal of Reading. We have had an amazing season three, and we're glad that you're back with us for another episode. We've got a great interview with S.D. Smith coming up in a few minutes on kindness from the novel Cry the Beloved Country, set in apartheid conditions in South Africa. SD, aka Sam, actually lived in South Africa. So he brings a lot of perspective to the conversation. So I hope you stick around for that. But right now I'm with Jessica and Austin, and we're going to talk about the virtue, the fruit of the Spirit, kindness. Kindness is interesting, friends, because it can feel like a really flat and sort of empty term on its own that is just sort of bland, but it does have deep and rich meaning when we think about it scripturally and theologically. So maybe we can start with this. Why do we get kindness wrong? Why does it feel like an empty term? And let's start there, and then maybe we can sort of course correct and fill out its meaning. But why does kindness feel like an sort of empty, blah, bland sort of idea or phrase?
Oh, that's beautiful. I look forward to getting to hear your conversation, because I can imagine Sam would have a ton to say about this. You know, in my house, we say be kind instead of be nice, because nice is even a flatter word. And I'm so glad that the fruit of the Spirit is not niceness, because, you know, niceness is a word that means nothing anymore. It's so superficial, whereas kindness goes deeper. So I think if we contrast it first with niceness, we start to see how it is a richer word. Right? It's not just about your manners or just your behaviors. It's about your disposition to the people around you. So Amy Peterson, who has a degree from Duke, and she's, as you mentioned, Claude, you know her too, an Episcopal priest in Asheville. She wrote this amazing book called Where Goodness Still Grows. And she investigates kindness and talks about its root word kin, meaning family. Kindness is where you treat everyone around you as family. And this is not, you know, C.S. Lewis also wrote this passage where he says, like, you usually are the worst to your family, right? You abuse your family because you know they're going to continue to love you, you know, despite you yelling at them, whereas you would never just yell at someone you barely knew. And so Amy, you know, kind of reroutes it and says, the way that you treat your family, though, is with a certain vulnerability, with an ability to love, an openness to being hurt, really, but also that open wideness is what to fully embrace the other too, right? So it's a both and that I found really strong in her work. So I think that that's where we find kindness having more meaning than sometimes how we use it just in conversation.
I think that's rich. And I think contrasting kindness with niceness is a helpful distinction too, Jessica, because I think kindness suggests a recognition of the shared humanity of the person with whom you're attempting to be kind. Whereas niceness can just describe a non-hostile disposition that doesn't really take into account the humanity of the other, that just, you know, is attempting to be just non-hostile or just a banal, you know, encounter. Whereas kindness is active, and that activity is rooted in, as you said, a disposition that inevitably understands and recognizes and apprehends the humanity of the person to whom you're offering kindness.
I also think, let me weigh in real quick, and then I'll hear want to hear what you have to say, Jessica. I think the other thing with kindness too is, and maybe we can get to this, is I also think of it as sort of like a, in a positive sense, a sort of conglomerate term, like a junk drawer sort of term. Like, I think there's a lot of like branches connected to kindness in terms of how it sort of works out. Jessica, what were you going to say? You could pick up on that thread or you could totally disregard it.
No, I was just thinking, you know, oftentimes we talk about like, how did we learn what we just learned about kindness through novels? And I remember reading Cry the Beloved Country in high school, and I can see how this will play out. So I don't want to, you know, steal the thunder of whatever conversation you guys are about to have. I'll get to listen to it soon. But Amy talks about it in terms of Native Americans and Americans and the relationship between the two. How would we treat each other like family, which of course we did not, you know, when America was colonized. But it makes me think of a book, Caleb's Crossing. It's not a great piece of literature, but it is a really good novel. It's about the first Native American to go to Harvard. And the reason he's able to is because of the hospitality, the kindness, not to conflate that too much, but that's the branch that I would see in that novel. The way kindness appears in that novel is the hospitality of people to treat one another like family, even across racial differences in that work. And because of that, like there's a beautiful story that I don't want to ruin, where people just learn to be people together. And yeah, so I'd recommend that to people, especially if you're looking for something, just a really good read. You know, Gertrude, what is her last name? Brooks, I think it is. I'm so bad with last names, y'all. But she got a Pulitzer for one of her novels. So she is a really great novelist. But Gwendolyn Brooks. Oh, I got
Gwendolyn
it.
Brooks. Oh, okay. It. Yeah, I know that name. Okay.
I didn't know
that. Okay. Yeah. There you go. Look at you.
Caleb's Crossing.
Okay.
Yeah, that taught me kindness. That would be the one I would pick.
Yeah. I think a recent novel, I may have mentioned this on one of our episodes, Min Jin Lee's Pachinko, that also, you know, maybe of interest to some of our listeners and to Austin and I, great portrayals of pastors. That's fun to see in literature from time to time, you know, pastors doing well. That's helpful. It's encouraging. I think there's a real thread if we're drawing from Amy's kind of working definition, kindness, kin, treating everyone as family. There's a really strong thread of that throughout the novel. And I think it also helps us situate kindness as our kindness is enacted and exists in a world that is broken and is very harsh and cold and cruel. So I think of kindness as sort of the counter to the cruelty of the world. And that really does come through in Pachinko, and it does come through as well in Cry the Beloved Country.
You're thinking along the same lines I was just thinking, Claude. Pachinko was a great novel, by the way. I completely agree. And I've been struck before by how immediately captivating the famous line that gets bandied about a lot, but the Scottish minister Ian McLaren is the one that usually gets attributed the original source, but the "be kind, you never know what battles other folks are facing." That if folks hear that and you tend to see on their face a recognition and it's a powerful line. It's not just because it's a reminder, but I think to the point that you're both making and Claude, that you just put your finger on there, that one of the things is that those with whom that we're family, we know their struggles. No matter how much tension there might be, we know their life story. We know what they're trying to overcome, even when we might be at odds with them. We recognize not just the shared humanity, but like the depths of the brokenness and the cruelty of the world, and we're able to empathize and have compassion in a way that it can be harder for folks when we don't immediately recognize what's happening for them behind closed doors. But I think kindness, the fact that it's connected in that quote and tends to affect people in that way when they hear it, I think it gives us a bit of an insight into one of the things that substantiates kindness and distinguishes it from something like niceness, to Jessica's point, is that kindness is a response to the cruelty and the brokenness of the world, and a recognition that life is hard for everybody, and that by being kind to someone, you're honoring the fact that their life is not perfect, that this little act of kindness, other than just a a polite nicety is in fact something that's going to be sustaining for them, nourishing, nurturing.
That's a great last word, Austin. And it really does dovetail perfectly into this conversation with SD Smith on Cry the Beloved Country. So friends, stick around, enjoy that. Send us a note, leave a comment, rate, review, share, all of that good stuff, and enjoy this interview. All right, friends. Well, I'm excited to have this interview conversation with Sam Smith, who goes by the author name S.D. Smith. He is the author of the Green Ember series, a million-selling adventure saga featuring heroic hashtag rabbits with swords. The Green Ember series has spent time as the number one best-selling audiobook in the world on Audible. Sam is also the author of The Madcap, Mooses with Bazookas, and Other Stories Children Should Never Read, which I cannot wait to buy for my middle child for Christmas. Sam is also the author of Jack Zulu and the Waylander's Key, a fantasy adventure novel, which he co-wrote with his son. Smith's stories are captivating readers across the globe who are hungry for new stories with an old soul. Smith is also a founder and owner of Story Warren, a publishing, events, and IP development house based in rural West Virginia. Story Warren exists to serve families as allies in imagination. And he lives in Grandview, West Virginia, with his wife and four kids. Sam, it's good to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about Cry the Beloved Country, written by Alan Paton. Came out in 1948. Before we get into kind of a little bit of, you know, what this novel is about, we'll jump into that too, maybe a little summary for folks to know. But maybe you could start us off with, when did you first encounter this novel? From my experience, I think a lot of people, this is a novel that, depending on folks' age, they may be encountered actually like in high school. Like, it's kind of one of those staples, kind of a classic that has sold many copies, been adapted into film. So when did you first encounter this novel? And then we'll kind of talk a little bit about why this novel matters, a little bit of synopsis, and then jump into discussion on kindness. But when did you first come across this work?
I can't remember. It's one of those things, like you said, I sort of heard about it. I was kind of a late reader. It's unusual, I think, for a lot of authors. Feels like a lot of authors grew up around books, and that was just they were reading from a very early age, and that was just not my story. I played sports, and a lot of boys and men in my sort of culture community didn't read a whole lot, so that was just like a different thing for me. So I started reading when I was 15, I think. I mean, I could read, but I just didn't read for pleasure or anything like that. So I started reading a lot when I was 15 and just got really hooked and started sort of trying to catch up. And I loved English literature. I loved classics a whole lot. I sort of veered that way. I got exposed to Shakespeare kind of early on, and I just got really hooked with that. But I would say, it may have just come sort of like in the, oh, these are the books you're supposed to read, like To Kill a Mockingbird and this kind of thing. But I lived in South Africa. When I was 12 years old, we moved to South Africa. So I was a missionary kid. I moved when I was 12. My first birthday in South Africa, I turned 13 the day Nelson Mandela was released from prison, and I was there. And so the South Africa shaped me a whole lot. I was there most of my teenage years. So when I went there, Mandela was in prison, and when I left, he was the president. So it was just an amazing time to be there. So I heard a lot about it there, and I heard a lot about it back here, just sort of in literary, sort of in that field. Oh, these are the books you should be reading. So it kind of like, but I think that my memory is that I came to it fairly late, surprisingly. So I think I was either in my 20s or my 30s, maybe by the time I actually sat down. I did not read it when I was in South Africa. I don't think I read it in high school. But when I did read it, I related to it profoundly, because it starts off in what they call then Natal, now is KwaZulu-Natal, and that's where I lived. And so it's very evocative for me. And actually, the story takes place in Natal and then in Johannesburg, and those are the two places that I lived. And so it's kind of personal in a lot of ways. I lived, the first church I was a member of was a Zulu church, and so it's the and the main character in this book is a Zulu umfundis, a pastor. My dad was called umfundis for many years. I heard him called that, you know, thousands of times. So it's very personal to me. Even before I read it, but when I read it, it rang a lot of bells.
You kind of had a lived experience in the context and in the place. So that's extremely unique for folks to get a little bit of a synopsis. Cry the Beloved Country is set in South Africa during apartheid. It follows the Zulu pastor, priest, Stephen Kumalo. He is searching for his son. He's searching for a couple of family members, but he ends up searching for his son, Absalom. And so he has to sort of journey out from small town into the city, really into kind of like the modern world of Johannesburg. And he does so, and it's a different world for him. He has to sort of be guided. He doesn't know his way. It's a strange and foreign land, essentially. And as he's searching for his son, he finds out that his son has been caught up in the murder of a man, Mr. Jarvis, who was doing social reform and activism. He's been working for the rights of the native people there against oppression and apartheid. And so now Kumalo has to navigate this profound tragedy, which as the novel unfolds, he realizes this tragedy has several deep layers that are connected to his life back home. And so it's a novel that deals, you watch a character sort of spiral into deeper and deeper anguish and suffering. And yet at the same time as Father Kumalo is experiencing this, there are other people who come around him with kindness and with love. There's a character of Father Vincent. There's the lawyer, Mr. Carmichael. And so it's this novel that's really poignant and painful in regards to suffering and injustice. And yet at the same time, it is regarded as a novel that is hopeful as well, that there is a sort of hope and love and endurance that can arise even in the face of real suffering. So hopefully that helps people paint the picture. It's a novel worth reading. If you haven't got to it, I came to it late as well. When you think about this novel, we've been talking about kindness, and your kindness is one of the fruits of the Spirit. I'm thinking even of Ephesians 4, the Apostle Paul really lays this vision where Christians are called to sort of be emblems of kindness out of God's kindness. And Ephesians 4:31, the Apostle Paul says, "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice, and be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you." So the sort of kindness that God gives to us, summed up in forgiveness and mercy, is supposed to mark the people of God. I'm wondering, you know, when you think about this idea of kindness, how do you see that as a thread in Cry the Beloved Country? Where do you see kindness? Or maybe, you know, where do you see in the novel the absence of kindness, maybe cruelty or harshness?
Well, that's a great summary of the book. And even while you're sort of doing the summary, I was just thinking of the other points of resonance that exist in it. I'm from super rural West Virginia, lived in rural South Africa too, and then moved to Joburg, and just sort of, I relate so much to Kumalo's experience. It's also it's a Christian, very, very Christian novel too, but it's also even almost particularly Anglican in many ways, which when I first read it, I wasn't an Anglican. My last reading, which was recently, I was. And so I almost related to it again in another new way. So it's just, it hits me in so many ways. But to me, when I think about kindness in the book, I think about Mzimango, the character who is, I think he is just one of the heroes of the story for sure. He has the quote of the book, in my opinion, which is just stuck with me when he's confronted with his goodness. And it's not all the characters are complicated. So when you talked about like the opposite of kindness, like Kumalo, who is a good man, a priest, he at times wants to hurt people with his words and wields the power of pain. And even Mzimango does that at times. There's so they're complicated people. They're not just sort of tropes, which I love. So they're interesting in that way. But I would say Mzimango is such a good and generous man, and when Father Kamalo says to him, you know, praises him, he says, "I'm a weak and sinful man, but God has put His hands on me. That is all." And that's repeated a few times in the story. But I relate to that so much in whatever even small success I have. That's how I feel. And when I first read those words, I thought, oh, that's life right there. I'm a weak and sinful man, but God has put His hands on me. So I think Mzimango's kindness, which is so pronounced in the story, I feel like relates to his humility, relates to his orientation toward God, who He is, and as a child of God. And that has a sort of a climax for him personally in the story, which ends with a really profound act of kindness toward the very poor Reverend Kamalo and his family. And so he's sort of an instrument for the renewal of a community and family in the midst of horrific tragedy and horrible news and death. So it was among those, to me, sort of epitomized. Actually, if you think about who, when you say kindness, I remember you talking about, is there a book that, you know, the theme of kindness? And I just immediately thought of him. I thought of the book, but I thought of him, that character, Mzimango. And he's not even in the story all the time. He's just in it. His presence is, it just oozes kindness, and it's from God. It feels like it's rooted in God, because he's a priest as well.
You know, the other thing that really resonates regarding the novel and hearing you talk about it, Sam, is sort of just the connection between the rural and the city. The connection between sort of dynamics of societies and civilizations. I'm thinking about, throughout the novel, one of the things that's really powerful, and this will, I think, further our discussion about kindness. One of the things that's really powerful is the social reform of the activist who is killed. His father doesn't really know the work that his son has been doing. And so he begins to, in the novel, he reads the letters of his son's sort of writings and speeches in which he's talking about the racism and the injustice that's happening. And it's a really powerful device for sort of drawing us deeply into this world. But what really struck me looking back on the novel, thinking through the thread of kindness, was the aspect that we can think about kindness in terms of interpersonal relations, but also like the world, because it's broken by sin, is in many ways not a kind place. Yeah, the world is a harsh place in many ways in many respects. There's also, of course, God's common grace, where we see the goodness and the beauty of the world and people and societies that works in a restraining way as well. But we have to acknowledge, right? It doesn't take much perusing of the news to really recognize the world is a cold and cruel place. It is an unkind place in many regards. And I'm struck by one part in the in one of the younger Mr. Jarvis, the son, the activist, where he's talking about the sort of old tribal system and the new civilization, and how the impact of the new civilization and social changes has destroyed tribal culture, leading to hopelessness, despair, crime, and all sorts of things. And so he says this. He says, "The old tribal system was destroyed by the impact of our own civilization. Our civilization has therefore an inescapable duty to set up another system of order and tradition and convention." And this really struck me because I was thinking about the novel in term through this lens of kindness and this sort of reality that we think of interpersonally, but also something that scales right to how we treat one another socially. And it just dawns on me, you know, talking with you about, you know, you have experience in the rural parts of South Africa, also coming into Johannesburg. You live in West Virginia. And so how do you think about those sort of dynamics, the connection between the rural, the city, and kindness on a level that goes beyond the interpersonal, but to how we relate to our neighbors kind of on large scale.
Yeah, boy. It's funny that you see that the letters of the son in the story sort of bearing fruit in the life of the father after he's gone, after the boy, after the son is gone. And it's sort of, you almost get to see a little bit of him making an effort, which I also love about the story, because it's not just a complaint or a lament, which there's a place for all that, but it is it's hopeful. You used the word hopeful earlier, in that it doesn't just shrug, which is a very easy thing to do in Africa, because you have again and again, the evilest thing in the world, colonialism, replaced by, hey, now we're free, and now you get a communist dictatorship, you know, it just happens again, or some kind of a dictatorship, another oppressive system, another, it's like, hey, this is a different brand of evil. And I'm not saying, oh, this one's better than that, but it's just, it's not great a lot. And so it's very tempting to just say, oh, it's tempting to, in America, it's tempting everywhere to sort of just throw your hands up and say, pox on all the houses. And but the power of an old Pavlov story to me is to see that that change is possible, that goodness is possible, that kindness is possible, and that it's worth it. That it's, and I think the one of the word that comes to mind about the book to me is it's beautiful. It's a beautiful book. And then like the second one is it's painful. I think about those together. And of course those don't always jive, but they seem to a lot in life and in literature. And so the despair of looking at cultural systems sort of and thinking, oh, well, there's just nothing to do about it. And I think you point out a particular one. I mean, my people here, poor sort of Appalachian people are sort of the, in many ways, they're not a very sexy group to sympathize with. You know, if you see a poor Appalachian in a film, it's almost always an object of scorn, because they're in a funny way to make fun of, which, you know, who cares? That's fine. But, or they're villains, you know, who are just horribly racist and horribly evil, and they hold bigoted, old-fashioned views. Often they go to church, they're Christians, but they're intolerant, horrible people. So they're not this group of people, but it's almost entirely, well, West Virginia is entirely rural. So the challenges of like the I mean, obviously in the United States, even the large part of our clashes are city versus rural, and the challenges of even with like Christians thinking about like church planting or that kind of thing, I am concerned about the challenges of overlooking rural people and the cost of that, and sometimes the cost of sort of an obsession with cities. The book is like a prophecy about it, or it's a revelation about what cities often do to disconnected people. They breed disconnected people, and disconnected people, you know, it's not to say that you often do, and maybe it's similar to what I was saying about the African continent in general, but when you're disconnected, you get different kind of problems. So you might have it's down with the old system, up with the new, with the new tyranny. And I think there are challenges in rural impoverished cultures. Certainly we've got so many, here. But I don't know if, that like the city's solutions are always the same, are always the right thing. You're asking more about this sort of the broader responsibility of people to other people, to the disruption of people, and the ongoing sort of wreckage of disruption. And that's certainly, I mean, that's played out all over Africa for sure, and here, And I mean, my own community is a community that is, it's a widowed place. It's a, people leave, people with resources, people with talent, people with opportunity leave. And so that has a compounding effect on the people left behind. Not only is there a lamentation, not only there's a sorrow associated with that, but there's a sort of a compounding dysfunction that happens in the wake of those people leaving. So I relate keenly to the sort of the both the beauty and the pain of Indochini in the book, and I relate to the hope of what is begins to happen at the end of that book. It makes me hopeful or and prayerful about the many places like that I'm aware of in Africa and the community I live in now, where I'm from originally. I don't think I answered your question at all, but I talked a lot.
I think you did. Yeah, I think you did. I mean, it's interesting to think about Kamalu's experience coming from, you know, kind of coming from the village, coming from the rural area, coming into Johannesburg, and his first experience, his first interaction, he's so bewildered and confused, and he's just shocked and overwhelmed. Buses, the people, the sounds, the buildings. And he doesn't know how to get the ticket to get on the bus. And his first interaction is he thinks he's being treated kindly, but he's actually being duped and his bag, you know, his stuff is being stolen. He's spotted as a mark. And so it's sort of like, okay, here you are now, this rural and urban intersection. And it's marked by, you know, from our lens, right? It's not just theft, but it's unkindness, right? A real lack of charity and hospitality to someone from a different place. And so I think there's a really interesting additional lens to think through this theme of kindness in relation to place in the novel as well. And as you mentioned, there is an act of sort of generosity and kindness and faithfulness and renewal that comes to this place, you know, outside the city toward the end of the novel, which I think is really fascinating and is part of that hope as well. But I do think, you know, the part of this novel, part of the gift of this novel, and one of the ways I think it can shape us as Christians, is to help us think about place, right? And to think about what is our relationship to one another through, you know, in terms of kindness, but also to the places, you know, that we call home, you know, the places that we belong to, the people that we belong to, you know, the people that are overlooked. And Kamalu, you know, as he comes into the city, he's certainly overlooked, or when he's looked at as sort of, you know, an easy target, right? Someone to be sort of used and abused in that sense. So I think there's a lot for us to think about from this novel, particularly in our context as Americans, as you mentioned, in relation to so many of our clashes are city versus rural, right? And those particular dynamics. I'm also interested in the way you mentioned the novel being beautiful and painful. I think that's a really great way to sort of sum up what's tied together here. And it's interesting. I was flipping back through the novel, trying to look at, you know, through this lens of kindness. And there are a couple of key places where actually Patton uses the term kindness. Kindness is a refrain, probably at least about somewhere between 8 or 10 times. And there's a really, really rich moment later in the novel. In my book, it's on 261. And Kamalu is sort of discussing, you know, if he's able to, like, if he's able to maintain faith, if he can continue to believe. And the context is, you know, the world is full of trouble. You know, his son has been found guilty despite the best efforts of Mr. Carmichael. His son is set to be executed. And Kamalu says this, he says, despite the pain of the world, he says, I believe, but I've learned that it is a secret. Pain and suffering, they are a secret. Kindness and love, they are a secret. But I have learned that kindness and love can pay for pain and suffering. There is my wife and you, my friend, and these people who welcomed me, and the child who is so eager to be here with us. This is the child of his son. So in my suffering, I can believe. And I think this is, you know, another really potent moment in the novel, and it's tying together both what you've laid out for us, Sam, the beauty and the pain of the novel, and then it's also showing that kindness and love have a way of not negating pain and suffering, but are a way of enduring, and in some sense, a way of moving through, almost overcoming in a way. What do you make of that that section from Kumalo as he's tying all these things together, really making sense of his own experience?
My last reading of it, I was struck by, I think it may be the exact part you're talking about, or that may have been just sort of almost the prelude to the thing I'm thinking of. But when he sort of at the end of the story, he's dealing with the impending death of his son by going up the mountain to pray. And I was struck exactly, I don't know if it's in exactly that passage, but he's done it several times. He's done it when he thought that his son was going to die as a young person from a health scare. He does it once. He goes up on the mountain to pray about a job, because he gets offered a job to work at a store that would have been made a lot more money. So it's basically like, should he leave his vocation as a priest? And then the other time, when he didn't tell his wife, is that he was tempted to adultery. And he said he spent time in that. Those are the three times, I think, if I remember correctly, that he spent time. So all just so relatable, you know, sort of like stuff of life kind of things. And that he keeps going to the Lord in the same way that Jesus did, you know, like in this remote place in a mountain to pray. And he does this at the end. And I can't believe what is astonishing to me is his orientation is so... He sees, and that's, you were talking about earlier, but like how people see him, like how the tricky guy that steals his money when he first goes to Joburg, that's a guy seeing him for what he, you know, sort of as a rube, a country rube or whatever. And then there's people like Mzimango who see him, and there's other people, there's even white people who see him as like a human being, you know, and it's a lot about seeing. And what does he see at the end? He's so, and we go through this despair and this tough and even sin with him, where he lashes out. But then when he's at this time, what does he do? In this moment of incredible despair, where you're just, if you're a human being and you're reading that and you're not moved to tears, I don't know what's going on. Because it's so deeply moving, just the pain of his situation is. I mean, I don't know if I really heard about that as a thing that actually happened in the world. I don't know if I would feel any different. That's the power of fiction to me. But I just went through it again, and it's fresh, and I feel it, you know, like a real loss, like a real funeral. And it's, but he, what does he do? He has this litany of thanksgiving all throughout. And it's a lot of it is about seeing, and he thanks God for Mzimango. And he piles on this list of things to be thankful for. And lots of them happened in Johannesburg. Lots of them happened from people in Johannesburg seeing him, white people, black people, people in the priesthood, people, you know, outside of it. And he just, it's like he counts his blessings, and he does it over and over again in the face of sort of lots of really evidence to the contrary. He has this, but I don't think it's naive, but it's audacious, you know, his gratitude and his capacity for hope is pretty, I was challenged by it, because it immediately made me think like, oh, am I seeing that? Am I seeing the kindness of God in my life and the kindness of God through people? So it's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful on so many, in so many ways, insightful, deep, powerful. That part of the book where he is seeing things and recounting them. And sometimes it's Patton or Peyton saying that, you know, sort of, he has a lot of, it's a really weird book because it doesn't exactly go straight. There's commentary, and it's like,
there is. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
So it's, you're not inside Kumalo. It's a very, so Kumalo is the main character, but there's a lot about Jarvis, and it's a lot. It's really not, it's a very much a, Alan Payton's a white South African. It's a very much a white South African book in a lot of ways, even though it's sort of centers Zulu character, but it's a lot about the kindness of white folks against the, you know, the maybe the custom of the day. That's that stood out to me again this last time, surprisingly. So it's a weird book, but yeah, to me that whole litany of Thanksgiving in the face of unbelievable grief and bad, evil news, evil tidings, evil circumstances, and even checks himself. Say, what if I'd gone a week earlier? And I would just like, yeah, man, I would be living in that. I'd be rolling around in that. And he's just like, that's not, you know, that's a silly thing to dwell on. And I'm like, how could you not dwell on that all the time? And he's just, that's not, you know, so he's got this surrender to God and gratitude in the face of it that is deeply painful and profoundly beautiful.
And that's helpful, because that might be some of the gift that the novel presents readers in terms of how to walk in pain and suffering, how to, you know, there's a sort of ability that's still there for Kamalo to see and receive kindness, right? To, you know, the Thanksgiving is the product of this recognition of these gifts, right? These gifts of kindness that have come from God, but have come through these people constantly. You know, as he comes to the city, he's being, he's preyed upon in the first instance, but in many other instances, people are welcoming him. They're putting him up in their homes. They're showing him how to navigate things. Mr. Carmichael, the lawyer, says, you know, I'm going to do this not pro bono, but pro deo, like for God's sake, for free. I'm doing this unto the Lord. All of these different instances. And Kamalo sees, though, he gives thanks for all of these things at the end in the midst of this pain, because he sees God's kindness to him through these people, despite a real horrific loss. And I think, you know, that can be instructive for us, you know, to sort of look and to see where, you know, where is the kindness of God present around us through people. And it's also something that we can look for and receive, but it's also something that we can, by God's help and grace, act out, you know, we can be agents of kindness, right? To be kind in a harsh world is to be an agent of God's kindness. And we can do that, you know, through the help of the Spirit, how we see our neighbors, you know, how we welcome them, we can offer a kind word, a kind meal, you know, a kind handshake, a kind, you know, there's all sorts of ways that we can do this. And so I think I'm really helped by talking through this with you, because that's sort of peeled back some of these new layers of, okay, this is what Kamalo is walking through. And I think this kindness lens really does illumine a whole lot.
Oh man. Yeah. And don't you think that so many of the, we're talking about beauty and pain, all that kind of stuff, like, to me, the fiction or real stuff, whatever, that deals with suffering, like, that's what I want to read, and that's what I feel like I need in my life. Is like, I don't really need stuff that helps me indulge in my bitterness or rage or my resentment or my pride, or like the stuff that, and I feel like there's a lot of fuel for that. Like, there's so much fuel for envy just everywhere, because that's like our system. It feels like it's just like, you know, trying to get as much as other people. And I guess that's just been the way from the beginning, why we have the Ten Commandments, you know, but it's not just Kamalo, you know, that's what Jarvis does too. What Jarvis is in the face of, and so all of these, it's to me, I find a lot of books or a lot of great stories are about fathers and sons. And that's what this book is about, obviously. And Absalom, I mean, it's right on the nose with the name Absalom, you know, but then Jarvis and his son, I mean, and it's this father becoming the child of the son philosophically in a way, and sort of living out. And what does he do as a result of the murder of his son? His life changes into one of intense kindness and like particular kindness. And it's pretty beautiful, you know, and it's part of the healing of Endu Cheney, which is this sort of like sadness underneath a lot of even the particular sadness of the fathers and sons and the death and the murder and crime and all this kind of stuff. It's like these places, like you said, this dry, and in the book it's dry, it's like literally dry, no rain and barren, and the people are leaving, and it's so many ways I just think, oh, this feels very close to home and in many, many ways. but what is the, you know, it's the particular kindness and the particular gifts of what Jarvis is capable of is very different than what and even the particular assignment of a native expert in farming is this sort of vision of his son just being lived out. Anyway, he reacts to the worst thing that can happen in the world by having this very Christian kindness.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And it's showing us this is possible, right? This is a way, this is a way we can be, and we can't control, we can't control this world. We can't control the evil. We can't control tragedy. You know, certainly we're called to righteousness in every way. Right. But we can't control these things, but you know, there is a way to respond that doesn't perpetuate the same cycle, but tries to break free into a new path, you know, by God's help. So, yeah, I appreciate you, Sam, making time diving into this with us. Where can people stay up to date with your work? How can people stay tapped in with you?
Well, I'm just your summary there at the end makes me like not want to tell anyone to go online for anything.
Don't go online.
Online is the place of the impotent rage. You know, it's like where it's exactly the opposite of this sort of like doing things that are actually sort of new creation sort of stuff. But you can find me at sdsmith.com. I think all my stuff's on there. If people want to.
We'll have
read
that in the
much
in the...
worse books than Cry the Book. if you want to read a lot way down from Mooses with Bazookas should not be mentioned in the same in the same sentence as Cry the Beloved Country. But I tell you what, that book did inspire me to think like what's the story of my people or my place. Like I've been thinking about that before that, but that book really encouraged me to think to keep sort of the soil of my soul awake for the seeds that could grow into a story that tried to tell my people's sort of or my place's story, like in a way that was as generous and beautiful or as I can do, I guess.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah, I think that place element to this novel is really powerful. So I hope people will meditate on that as well. Sam, thank you. You've given us some good things to consider around this really great novel. Appreciate your time, man.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.